have Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Friday! This is Mark Maron with Mark Riley, Stu Ellicott. I'm repeating what the little tape thing just said. Good morning. Today I prepared a special edition of the Presidential Palm Pilot because I could, and I've also got an early copy of today's liberal agenda because I can, because I could. It was just there for the taking. Right now, I've got Mark Riley. How are you? Sue Ellicott's here.
Hi.
Nice to see you guys.
Right, we're here because we can.
Unbelievable. Sue brings in like two boxes of Magnolia cupcakes, which are just pure butter and sugar.
And we're zooming.
So now, I've got that coursing through my veins. I feel the arteries around my heart going.
Yeah, but you get a rush first.
I got a good buzz on. I'm waiting for the cupcake crash. My wife came into town yesterday. And you know what's amazing? That when you don't see somebody that you're married to for 3 weeks, there comes a point where you cross this line where you're like, oh, no, what if we don't know each other anymore? What if it doesn't, what if we don't smell right to each other anymore? What if I see her and I'm like, uh-oh, I don't, what am I going to do with her?
I really hope she's not up this early and listening.
Well, you haven't heard me finish my little thing.
Okay.
And the beautiful thing about it is I am so in love with this girl. Like, and I'm so baffled by it because, like, you ever been with a woman or a man for a long time that you're just in it because, you know, you're in it because you don't know how to get out of it, and it's sort of, like, tedious and hard and difficult, and you got to pretend and hope everything works so they don't know that you hate them inside? So, but like, when Mishma came, when she came to my house yesterday, I just sat there looking at her like, I am so lucky. How did I get so lucky? And I'm so glad I have a clear conscience about everything. Like, I'm not hiding anything, so it's all pure. Like, I don't think I've ever felt what it's like to be as in love as I am now.
Okay, but now we have to ask her what she thinks.
All right, well, she's not up yet.
I got a question.
Yeah.
You just said something very interesting.
Yeah.
You said, when I brought her to my house.
Yeah.
Your house?
Yeah.
Didn't you get married in California?
When?
Oh, when,
when I brought her to my
house. That means it's half hers.
Oh, that house is, but the one here in Astoria is sort of like old stuff from my old life. That one that here in
you
Astoria.
You have no old life.
No, it's all new.
You got married in California.
That's the new life.
Half of your old life is now her life.
It's a communal property apartment. That's what he's trying to tell you.
Oh, no, definitely, definitely. That happens sometimes. At least I didn't call her my girlfriend. That happens too. You know, when you're newly married, you're like, well, my girlfriend, like, you mean your wife?
Wife, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we did do that.
Yeah.
I remember that day. We got married, kind of. I'll read one email and then we'll go into the news.
Please.
It is Friday and it is Father's Day is on Sunday. My father, what can you say about my father? I just wanted to say a few things about fathers if we could, because Sunday is Father's Day, I guess. Though I don't really believe in these days. I think it's just a scam to sell cards and flowers and ties. But what can I say about my dad? If my dad were a knight, he would be Barry the Bitter.
Barry the Bitter?
Yes, he's a very bitter man. Sir Barry the Bitter. But I love the guy, you know. It took me a long time to realize that I did. But I hope he has a good day. I think we're going to try and get him on the phone to do some movie reviews.
Yeah?
Yeah, because cool. My dad, like, he calls me last week, and he's like, yeah, I read about this movie where the guy eats McDonald's or something. And it's Double Size Me, right? Double Size Me? Anyways. One email, then we're going to move into the news. This must be from yesterday. Sounds to me that you're merely a liberal puppet. Lots of luck. After November, maybe you guys can sell used cars. Well, the great thing about after November is that when Kerry's president, it's going to be a lot easier for us to do this show in a lot of ways. And if Bush is president, it'll be filled with anger. If Kerry's president, we're going to be filled with joy, and then we'll just be, you know, we'll have all kinds of things to talk about. But the thing is, the idea of a liberal puppet, this is the funny thing about the right, who have a lot more puppets than the left, because you know why? The right is very focused and narrow-minded and very selective in how they view the world, very black and white. So it's a lot easier to be a puppet when the agenda is so narrow. As far as the left goes, if he really knew what liberals were like and how, you know, distracted and confused and sensitive and not on the same page they are, he would realize that if there was such a thing as a liberal puppet, he would be ripped apart by the hundreds of puppeteers that were trying to control it. So I just wanted to let you know, we are working on building an agenda. I just read Robert Reich's book. Reason, which is great. And he's got some plans for an agenda, and we're going to talk about it with him on Monday. So what do you got for the news there, Riley?
Well, now you got me nervous, man, because I don't want to sound like a liberal puppet.
We're not liberal puppets. There's
we deliver
thing.
The news here.
Isn't
we
are that individuals. Better than a cackling geezer?
Yeah, you're right.
You can choose.
You're right.
It's your turn.
Hey, Greg in Rockville, Maryland.
How about a cackling puppet? Do the cackling
there
puppet
we go.
On the news, Riley.
Well, you remember earlier this week when the Western and stylish Hamid Karzai was in the White House Rose Garden.
Without his hat?
Without his hat.
Carrying his pimp cape?
Carrying his lime green pimp cape.
That was a cool cape.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. It was so warm, in fact, he couldn't even wear it. Then he ended up standing next to President Bush as President Bush declared that Afghanistan had ceased to be a terror factory. It was a bastion of democracy, whatever else the hell it was.
Well, that was 2 days ago.
All right. Well, yesterday, a videotape was released on the Arab language TV outlet Al Jazeera. And that videotape, if true, would appear to indicate otherwise. The tape purports to show Al-Qaeda members receiving training at a camp inside, guess where?
Afghanistan?
Ka-ching! A terrorism expert told the New York Times the camp may have been in Pakistan, but it appears to be genuine. He added the tape shows new confidence on the part of the Al-Qaeda terror network. Hmm. Now, what would possibly make Al-Qaeda confident?
The fact that the U.S. is not winning the war on terror?
That could be it.
Ka-ching.
Maybe the latest polling that shows it's still a close race between Bush and Kerry. I think that the Al-Qaeda terror network wants Bush reelected. That's just my own feeling. Okay.
So you're saying they're campaigning for Bush?
Oh, well, not campaigning.
That Osama is deep in the hills of Afghanistan going, vote for Bush.
Yeah. I think they're training on the possibility that Bush gets reelected because, well, let me not be an alarmist or a speculator about these things.
Well, he's done more to unite terrorism than anyone has in years.
And I think that they also believe that under Bush, America will never get its anti-terror act together enough to stop them.
Well, you know, think they're just anti-American in a much bigger way than they are, you know, anti-Bush, pro-Kerry, pro-Bush, anti-Kerry. I think whoever is in office, they will find a way to target America and Americans.
The thing is that a universal, or not universal, an international coalition of people monitoring this stuff is necessary. And this president has alienated the international community to such a degree that the hopes for that are completely negligible, right? They're not going to happen. Is that the right word? Negligible?
That's the word, negligible.
And the only hope that we have is that somebody like Kerry could get into office, create some sort of international alliance on a law enforcement level to really monitor this stuff effectively and restructure the way we fight terrorism by, you know, by being stubborn and confrontational in the way that Bush is. There's just no way to navigate this thing.
But see, the problem that you have here, the fundamental problem, in addition to the international links, is the fact that the agencies that are charged with law enforcement and fighting terrorism inside the country don't communicate with each other. The CIA doesn't talk to the FBI, doesn't talk to the Attorney General, doesn't talk to Homeland Security.
No one's talking to each other.
Nobody's talking to each other.
And Homeland Security is supposed to bring it all together.
So how are you supposed to fight terror if every agency that may have a small bit of that fight has a different agenda from the other?
And that's just in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just in this country, not to say for the rest of the world. And also, it almost becomes impossible. I read something recently that the borders and what's coming into this country is completely like the shipping, the ports. They don't have any handle on that. They just don't have any handle on it.
Right, yeah, I think the intelligence is one thing, but the diplomacy is another. And that's where I think that Kerry would make a difference, is that, you know, there's so much criticism against the Bush administration is that they've used aggression. They have tried to look at Iraq as their sort of landing stage to spread democracy through the Middle East. And that is just wrong. They should be, you know, they should be looking at other places and Egypt and an intellectual base. And if Kerry can do that, then I think he does threaten Al-Qaeda, because, you know, Bush's approach has fomented terrorism through the Middle East.
Uh-huh. And it's failed. I mean, plain and simple, he has failed at this war on terror.
And we've got proof.
Dare we say it?
We've got proof.
Now, he's still, you know, continuing to dispute the findings of the 9/11 Commission, but we'll get back to that.
Yeah, hang on out there. That's hang on to the wheel. Hang on to your cup of coffee. We're going to come back with some proof on Air America Radio. On the cloud, 19 past the hour. It's morning sedition again on Friday. I'm Mark Maron. This is Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. You're listening to Air America Radio, as usual, I hope. So, the Bush administration apparently believes in magic. They are doing a very magical thing now. They are repeating a line over and over again as if it has some sort of magical powers in hopes that the truth will disappear. Al-Qaeda and Iraq were connected. Al-Qaeda and Iraq were connected. Say it a lot of different times through a lot of different mouths within the administration, and hopefully, shazam, the truth
Saddam
has disappeared.
Link,
Saddam!
Link, link.
That was clever. That's so funny. That
link, 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 link.
Good one, Sue.
He's trying to do, he's continuing now, and see, this is how Bush got himself in trouble.
Wait, let me do one more. Abra Al-Qaeda.
We started out Monday with Dick Cheney saying that there's a link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. Mm. Not the first time he said it, but the first time this week he said it. Here we are on Friday, and we're still talking, because the president is still talking, about the link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And, of course, in the intervening period, the 9/11 Commission said there was no direct evidence of a link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Bush and his spokespeople continue to soft-pedal their way back from assertions they made during the run-up to war with Iraq about Saddam and that relationship
God
with
forbid
Al-Qaeda.
They just say, you know what, we no.
Well, remember, before the war,
yeah,
George W. Bush portrayed Saddam and Iraq as an imminent threat, not just some ordinary everyday threat, an imminent threat to the security of the United States.
Because of weapons of mass destruction.
And because that's the only way you can really declare a war like this mm-hmm. and get away with it. You have to say, you can't just say they're a threat. You yeah. can't just say, you know, not nice to his people.
You can't say they're pesky.
You have to say he's an imminent threat.
But the imminent threat, Mark Maron was right, it was about the weapons of mass destruction, and the second plank to that was about harboring terrorism. It was.
That's
he
right.
clearly made the link with terrorism, although he's denying that he says Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11. They made the terrorist connection.
Well, let's listen to what
They're
our president
crafty.
Had to say. Let's hear what he had to say just yesterday.
This administration never said that the 9/11 attacks were orchestrated between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. We did say there were numerous contacts between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
Can I quote Saddam Hussein in USA Today?
Yes, please quote Saddam.
February 4th, 2003. If we had a relationship with Al-Qaeda, we wouldn't be ashamed to admit it.
All right.
I will speculate that I think that Bush probably has more connections to bin Laden than Saddam Hussein actually has.
I think you wouldn't be that far wrong. Now, that was in February 2003, right?
Yeah.
Let's fast forward just over a month. On March 18th, 2003, George W. Bush sent a letter to Congress outlining the legal justification for going to war. In it, he wrote that the U.S. was justified in taking, and this is a direct quote, the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that were launched on September 11th, 2001. End quote.
See how they phrase it weird. They're very suggestive, but they don't quite commit to it. I mean, apparently, yeah, Al-Qaeda operatives went into Iraq to try and get Saddam on their team, and Saddam he wanted nothing to do with it. You know, Saddam didn't want to
they
be involved with
them. They never responded even.
Exactly. So these guys, it's like somebody going, you know, just saying, hey, can I get work? No, we don't have any jobs. All right, thanks. See you later. He was there, you know.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, and I mean, the thing is, this letter, which was sent to Congress to justify why Bush was going to war, specifically mentioned September 11th. Now, he wasn't going to war at that point against Afghanistan. We were already had supposedly fought a war against Afghanistan. This was a war on Iraq, and he specifically mentioned that part of the justification for going to war against Iraq was going after people involved in September 11th.
Yeah, but we can't expect Bush to dwell on any kind of details. I mean, his credibility is what is the issue here. I mean, it's beautiful. This is just such bad timing for Bush, this 9/11 Commission report, because he was just getting some traction last week with the handover stuff and the new Iraqi government and the G8 summit down on Sea Island with all the leaders and the presenting of them to the world. And it's shown that event to be just a shallow thing. It was really a photo opportunity. And now he is really looking bad. And all they can do is hammer away at this link. because it's the only thing that they have. It's the only thing that, it's their key issue to continue to persuade the American people that there was a reason to go to war.
But there is no link. I mean, the issue is that, like, they're hammering away at a lie. And the thing is, if you're an average person, if you're just a guy on the street, and the statement is this, is that Saddam has links to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is part of 9/11, but Saddam isn't linked to 9/11. All you really get is like Saddam, 9/11, Al-Qaeda. See? Yeah.
But it's a vital vicious circle they want to keep, you know, spinning and spinning.
But it's
and spinning.
A lie, and
it's
they're
a
just
lie.
Trying
Absolutely.
To program this
lie.
Into the brain.
It's if they, a lie, but the majority of Americans still think that there is a link between Al-Qaeda
because of the way it's phrased.
Exactly, and but even if that's diminished, they have to keep on bashing that because otherwise his whole It's such a tight race.
They're also pushing this this sort of like mildly different economy that, you know, these numbers that don't really indicate anything because they barely match up with the jobs that were lost during the Bush administration. But getting back to this Al-Qaeda thing is that this is a secretive administration, all right, that doesn't, you know, let out anything that's going on unless they're busted. But this is one of those situations where if they have this link, if this link is real and it's not just, you know, some terrorist activity in the no-fly zone, which was not under Saddam Hussein's control, or these failed attempts at terrorist organizations to gain favor within Iraq, mm-hmm. which don't really indicate a connection. They are not connections. They're just sort of proximity things. If all that's true, then Where is the evidence? Why would they be secretive about this? If they have real proof that there was a connection of a partnership, that why wouldn't they tell us?
They don't have it. And it's
so just, they're lying.
It's so amazingly arrogant. I find it just stunning that after the 9/11 commission, a bipartisan commission, has spent kind of months and kind of millions on really going through all the best available evidence, and, you know, we start to find out what their findings are, that a president would dare, basically, to challenge them. And say, you know what, I'm ignoring everything they say because we are sticking to our story that we had evidence of, you know, conclusive, direct, substantial ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
Well, he didn't want the 9/11 Commission in the first place.
No.
He didn't want to fund the 9/11 Commission, didn't want to give him a paltry $11 million when Ken Starr spent how much? But that's a whole nother
story. It's so gorgeous that having kind of delayed it, the timing of this commission's report coming out now most threatens his credibility. I think that's great.
Yeah, but, you know, if it works, the thing is that they are pandering to a group of people that they're pandering to the true believers. And these are people that will listen to the president, they'll listen to Cheney, and as opposed to say, like, look, this commission has worked for, you know, what, 9 months now? How long has it been?
Well, the commission? Yeah. I believe it's been a year and a half.
A year and a half to put together this case, and the people that
2 million documents.
The blind faithful that believe in this administration will actually say, you know, they're just spinning it. See, that panel, that committee, is just part of the liberal machine.
It's partisan. They're attacking the president. They're Bush.
They're politicizing. Even though it's headed by a Republican, they'll say that they're politicizing it, and they're coming out against the president who's telling the truth.
And he's lying on saying he's insisting the world is safer with Saddam Hussein gone. I mean, we're glad
that
he's gone.
Safer. We've proven that over and over again.
Richard Clark said the other day, it's just not, because money that they should have put into doing anti-terrorist efforts in Pakistan and Jordan and kind of beefing up that in other countries, all the energy and time and money has gone into concentrating on Iraq. Mess.
Well, look, they have a videotape that shows, an Al-Qaeda gym class essentially doing exercises somewhere in the world that America obviously has no access to, nor any ability to try and track.
It doesn't matter whether it is in Afghanistan, as they claim, or whether it's in the northern part of Pakistan. The fact is, they are there, and if that tape is credible and no one said it's not authentic, that's incredibly worrying.
Well, the thing is like we've been saying here for days, almost for 2 weeks, that we've got numbers that, you know, prove that terrorism activity is up, that, you know, this has done nothing but aggravate the situation. There were no active terrorist groups within Iraq until we invaded it, and that's the truth. There's proof of that. And I'll lay that out after the break if you want.
Or as Bill Murray said, that's a fact, Jack.
Yeah. See you in a minute.
Up next, the presidential palm pilot, Clinton, grabs the spotlight again. Plus, the all-important liberal agenda. Don't move. This is Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's 33 past the hour. It's Friday. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. I'm here with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. Father's Day is Sunday.
I celebrated last Sunday. I got it wrong.
That's because they don't have it where
no,
you live,
right?
No,
they do. Right? They use the American holiday in London, right. And so we got everything organized. And then I spoke to my dad, and he said, it's next week.
Mm. Well, it's a sad day for Paul Johnson's son. I mean, this whole appeal to get the Saudis to make a shift to release his dad. Hopefully there's hope there, but you know, it just sort of resonates throughout the country because everybody's sort of in shock still with the Nick Berg thing and what these guys are capable of. And the Saudis themselves are asking for more international support in their personal fight against terrorism within that country.
Well, he was abducted in Saudi Arabia last Saturday. There appear to be, according to published reports, few leads in the search. They say that the Saudis have 15,000 people on the streets of Riyadh, the capital, trying to perhaps raid some of these terrorist hotbeds, as they're called, to try and search for them. But I think that it may well be that the best-case scenario here, major possibility that this man may be spared may have come from a friend of his who is a Muslim who calls himself Saad the Believer.
Yeah.
Who actually put a message up on a website that's apparently used by supporters of Al-Qaeda and essentially said that I will curse you in all my prayers if Paul Johnson is harmed. It was posted late Wednesday, and it aired on a Saudi-owned television network, Al Arabiya. It also said that, ironically enough, Paul Johnson had a problem with what the American government was doing in Iraq.
Was considering on maybe becoming a Muslim.
Yeah,
he suggested.
Yeah. So this I think may be the one area where people might end up, his captors might end up listening. They're not going to listen to the Saudis. The Saudis aren't negotiating with terrorists. The Americans don't negotiate with terrorists. That means that essentially Paul Johnson will be as good as dead. I hate to put it that way, but barring this intervention, I think they would execute.
I mean, I think it looks good that he's doing that, but I don't know that it really would have any impact. I don't know that anybody who has gone as far as giving someone a 72-hour deadline and, threatening to kill him, on camera, that they really want to listen to someone who's a moderate Muslim.
Did they threaten to kill him on camera?
Maybe that's just the fear that they would do the same thing that they
well,
did.
Well, I mean, I think that a Muslim reaching out...
Yeah, it looks great, but I don't know whether it has any effect on the real terrorists.
Well, we'll find out. But the idea that there are, moderate Muslims in the world and actually, speaking against terrorism on any level is something you don't see very often. And, certainly not in this politicized way. And I think it's a great thing to know and to see that there are moderate Muslims that do not, believe in the same type of fanatical Islam that these people believe in. And you don't hear a lot about that, certainly not in the States. But for someone to reach out to an American friend as a moderate Muslim in an appeal to fanatics is a courageous thing, whether it has impact or not. As a symbolic gesture, it's certainly tremendous.
As a symbolic gesture, it's important. And in this instance, where there is no clue where these people are, where no one is going to negotiate with the captors, and as far as I know, there's no way they could. I don't know if they said, contact us at post office box, whatever. The bottom line is this is the one thread that the Johnson family back here in New Jersey may be able to hang their hat on, is that somebody has tried to intercede on this man's behalf.
Yeah, I hope so. And, the scary thing about a lot of these new terrorists, these Al-Qaeda franchises, is and many of them seem to be fighting for territory, not unlike, gangs and neighborhoods in a certain respect, that the way they use the media, the way they use the Internet, and the way they shoot their videos, clearly this guy who has taken Paul Johnson hostage, is trying to establish himself as one of the hardcore, new Al-Qaeda dudes that has to be reckoned with in that region.
Yeah, this is Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, Abdulaziz Isa Abdul Mohsin Al-Mokrin.
Yeah, and apparently he was involved in training in Afghanistan. He was a weapons runner for a long time, and now you've got these images on video of him in front of this bright red background, looking like some sort of evil, superhero villain.
And
presenting himself to the Muslim and to the world at large as a new guy to be reckoned with. It's really interesting how they're using the Internet and the media to propel their cause and to make them, appealing and, mythological, almost mythic, to the people that believe in their cause.
I think all the televising of this puts Americans in a difficult position, though, that when you have, you know, the prayer vigil that you can see on cable television and people crying and pleading for Johnson's release, and you have Johnson's son saying that, you know, he's in favor of the Saudi authorities releasing some militants in return for his father's freedom, saying, I know they can make a deal to make it happen. I think that puts people in a confusing position and gives them a false sense of expectation.
But it brings people together in a certain grief and a certain, you know, sort of hope, you know, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, you know, there's also a story in Der Spiegel, the German magazine,
yeah,
that those images of Paul Johnson were put on the internet via a firm based in Silicon Valley, California.
That's bizarre, right?
So that is bizarre.
I don't see that. I don't have the computer know-how or technology sense of how that operates.
I have no idea.
It was sad, you know, because, you know, people are coming together in Jersey. I heard a call-in from a classic rock station. Some dude said, you know, Father's Day's coming up. He felt bad for Paul Johnson's kid, and he said, maybe we should do something from New Jersey to maybe make the terrorists change their mind. And he said, how about a Bruce Springsteen song? And as ridiculous as it sounded, it was sort of touching. I mean, it really was. You know, if you want to call us with your thoughts about this, 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. I forgot to do the presidential palm pilot because I was sort of caught up in this story, and I will do that on the other side of this break. So give us a call if you'd like. Friday morning, we're taking your calls at 866-303-2270, 43 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning's Edition. I'm with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. It's now time for the presidential palm pilot, which was downloaded by my buddy in the Oval Office just moments ago. We got it late. That's a change in my story. Here's the president's schedule today, 7 o'clock a.m. Wake up, stay on message. Saddam definitely had long-standing ties to al-Qaeda. How long do I have to stay on this message? 8 o'clock a.m. Speak to military personnel, Fort Lewis, Washington. Tell them it's great to have an audience that's ordered to listen to you. 12:05 p.m. Fly to Reno. See if I can get a quickie divorce from reality.
No contest.
Grounds incompatibility. 1 p.m. Stop by Caesar's Palace. Have Bill Bennett play some bets for you. Yeah. 2:20 p.m. Address voters in Reno. Promise them the loosest slots in Washington. 3 p.m. While in Nevada, quietly dump nuclear waste. Quietly. On the down low. 3:30 p.m. Fly back to Washington, D.C. and then Camp David. During the layover, provide leadership. 11:40 p.m. Arrive at Camp David, smash and smear lightning bugs. Yeah. Look how fun it is for a second. 12:30 a.m. Make historic Camp David accord between graham crackers, chocolate, and marshmallows.
By the way, you know that thing you said about the loosest...
loosest slots?
You know that you can't say that in Vegas?
Really?
It's illegal. You cannot say that you have the Nevada Gaming Commission regulates how casinos can advertise themselves, and they cannot say, they can say they have loose slots or looser slots, but they cannot say the loosest slots.
So you can say you're selling the best ice cream in the world.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
We got callers, you know, very excited.
Let's go.
Calls 866-303-2270. We're going to Dave in Los Angeles. Dave.
Yeah, hey, guys.
Hey, Dave.
Up, man?
I have got very little sympathy for this guy in Saudi Arabia.
The hostage.
Because I think that regime are a bunch of pigs.
Yes.
They hate Americans.
Yes.
90% of the country hate Americans.
Yes.
You know, I put my butt on the line every day. Every day, my job, what I do.
What do you do?
Men and women dying. I'm driving a truck. I'm driving an 18-wheeler. And you don't hear a word about it, about how we in our lives, and I'm not doing it for some corrupt regime, I guess unless you count the Bushies. I'm doing it for my family. And I'm keeping America rolling.
I'm not.
Son of an SOB over there in Saudi Arabia propping up some corrupt government.
Well, hang on a minute.
Wait, are you
Paul
talking
Johnson
about
supporting his family too?
I mean, well, I'm not condemning his family. I'm just saying, if you lie down with dogs, you're going to get fleas.
So
and that's what happens if you live in Saudi Arabia.
But isn't that kind of blaming the victim? I mean, if you were really in his place, and I'm not sure I see the analogy between.
I wouldn't go there. They wouldn't let me in. You know, I'm a half Jew, half Sicilian. As far as they're concerned, I'm a monkey or a dog, you know? I wouldn't have anything to do with those pigs.
Dude, you got to...
If they see me, they would kill me.
I hope you're in the slow lane.
You're doing the big thinking in the truck there, buddy. I'm not sure I see the analogy between, you know, your job and maybe the military or anything else. I'm not sure I see how your job is similar to his.
Well, you don't see how risking your life is similar?
No, but how are you risking...
I'm going to South Central A, my friend. You go there this time of morning.
Where?
Oh,
so you're saying South Central?
Oh, South Central LA is like taking your life in your hands like, I hope you can drive across country. We got Harlem here in New York.
Pardon?
Nothing.
Thanks a lot for your call, Dave.
What the hell was that?
I think he's a little strung out on trucker speed. I'm not sure what's going on. But
what time is it out there?
He's on the road, and, you know, clearly he's a little delusional in the cab there. And
South Central. What is he afraid? Ice Cube's going to leap on the thing of his truck and say, hey, man, but, give me your money.
If I take sense from what he's saying, he seems to be saying that if you go over to a regime that he considers corrupt in order to kind of make money and that you kind of deserve what's coming to you, which seems a kind of oversimplification and kind of far-fetched and just kind of completely lacking in compassion.
Well, yeah,
not to mention reason.
He's blaming the victim, number one. Number two, I think he's misinterpreting why, you know, just because you have a job in another country doesn't mean that, you know, you should be killed like anywhere else. And then he said that his job is equally as dangerous. I guess, you know, walking across the street is dangerous, but it seemed like he was coming from a very self-centered, angry place.
You might be able to make a point that if you disagree with the ethics or the hypocrisy of a country's regime, then perhaps you shouldn't go and live
there.
Hey,
wait a minute. I just figured it out.
But if you do not deserve to be kidnapped and threatened with execution.
You know who that was?
Who?
Reginald Denny. You remember him?
Well, yeah, it's Reginald Denny's buddy, probably. Nick in New Jersey. How are you, Nick?
Yeah, it's a shame that, you know, we have to contend against, you know, the Sauds and then also the militants and all of the Islamic world. But it just seems like such a few bunch of people, just like our regime in 1984 land called America, is like just a few people can just screw up the perception of like a whole, you know, generations and generations of Arabs or Muslims around the world, you know.
I think that's the way racism usually works, is that, you know, if there is an example to be had, certainly from a group that people don't know a lot about and they are a bad example, certainly with more ignorant people, it will paint the entire picture for them as being negative.
Just one quick backtrack. I think that Reginald Denny was really an innocent bystander, by the way.
Of course he was.
There's no reason to believe that Reginald Denny, just because he was white, held the same views as the trucker we just spoke to.
No. I'm just saying, I thought it was Reginald Denny because he knows to be scared of being in South Central L.A.
Well,
otherwise, I had no reason. I couldn't figure out what he was talking about.
Well, I think that's what he was referring to. I mean, that would be the indicator, to put it in semiotic speak. Larry in Manhattan, how are you?
Good morning, folks. I'm good. How are you?
What's up, Larry?
A couple of things. First of all, I have worked in close connection with a number of Muslim people who are really fine people, and they have told me that what this radical fringe is not what Islam represents. However, I will say this, that to tie this into yesterday's conversation, that there is a religious kind of dictatorial or autocratic fringe in many of the world's religions, particularly the Western religions. We see it here with our right-wing fundamentalism.
Yeah, we talked about that with you yesterday.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that we need to deal with this in the Western religions. And, you know, on some levels, there is this intolerance that is almost impervious to fact. You know, they have their beliefs, and they don't want to hear anything else. And, you know, I think it's incumbent upon the other Muslims in the world to show them that, in fact, this doesn't go with the teachings of Muhammad.
Well, you know,
in fact, it doesn't.
Well, there is a sort of there is a criticism of the American Muslim communities of not, you know, sort of standing up for what true Islam means if it doesn't mean fanatical Islam. There has been a lack of conversation about that in this country, and certainly, you know, on the airwaves.
I got to ask a question about that, though, because I have been to press conferences many times with Islamic groups that say exactly that. You know how much media is there?
Zero.
Me.
Yeah. See, it's true. It's sort of been reinforced then by the lack of media coverage. We'll be back. We're going to talk about Big Bill after the break, so stand by. 54 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Friday morning. That was an interesting Collins segment.
Oh, sure.
An interesting day. I got Mark Ryle here, Sue Ellicott.
I just hope he wasn't trying to pass somebody.
Air America Radio. I just hope he comes down from whatever it is that he was up there on.
And he's at the beach, not in South Central.
I think he'd been up all night driving, you know, and he was worked up. You know, you get that dialogue going. I used to love driving because you get that thing going in your head. You know, the car you're in, the vehicle becomes like a spaceship. You know that feeling when you got the music blasting and you're high, and then you pull up to a gas station and people are looking at you like you just landed from outer space?
Because you have.
Yeah. So, you know, Bill Clinton is back in the news. He's back on the road. He's going to be on 60 Minutes on Sunday. He said, you know, he's doing interviews, and, you know, he basically, well, yeah, all right, there he is. Whenever we bring him up, it's he's certain to call. How are you, William in Chappaqua?
I'm good.
Why are you calling us, buddy?
Well, I'm calling you. I called you for the very worst reason, because I could.
Yeah, I've heard that excuse before. I heard you talking about it yesterday. I got to be honest with you. I do sympathize. I have been there in my life, having the ability to
certain things.
Well, I also want to let people know that I consider the whole impeachment process, the whole witch hunt, a badge of honor.
Uh huh. All right. Oh, look, there's your better half, Bill. And Bill in Harlem. How are you?
Well, let me tell you something.
Yeah.
I was honored, but I don't think I should get a badge for it. what did I say? I'm a bad man. So, I love the attention, Mark.
Yeah.
It's all me all the time. It's
fantastic. Yeah.
You know, I can feel my legacy just coming back stronger and harder.
Hey, we're on the radio here.
Oh, my legacy is so huge. Oh, it's fantastic. Oh, my God.
So, you know, there was a little concern. I heard you talking on the TV yesterday about, you know, your marriage was on the rocks, huh?
Well, you know, that's true. I mean, would you marry me? Come on, buddy. But I'm not gonna cry over spilled.
We get it.
Spilled and dried.
Yeah.
So Elvis needed playtime, and I'm not gonna apologize now. Yeah.
So they were out to get you, huh, Bill?
Oh, they're all out to get me. Yeah. But, you know, the ladies like the bad man. Ladies like a rebel.
So where are you going? You're going to be on 60 Minutes on Sunday, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to go into any detail about anything?
Well, you know, I'm trying to sell a book, mister. I'm not going to give away all my candy at once. So you can ask my lady friends about that.
Wow.
You got to take your time, do it right.
Well, thanks for calling, President Clinton.
All
it's always
right,
a pleasure talking to you.
All right.
We got his friend on later in the show,
Harry
Thomason, the guy who made the new film that Sue saw.
Yeah, and it's Clinton this week.
What's it called, The Hunting of the President?
Hunting of the President. The speech that Clinton gave afterwards, or the talk, or the sort of, you know, the...
A two-hour jam session.
Well, no, it was more like sort of a lecture or sort of an analysis of American politics and history.
But then he closed it with the big, they were out to get me.
He did, but he started it with something even better. He started it with saying the two things that excite him in American culture and politics today are move on. .org and Air America Radio.
Right, but again, did he mention me or you or Mark Ryan?
You know,
I mean, I'm glad that Franken was there and everything. And, you know, listen,
and
Al Franken.
And he did mention Al Franken.
Yeah, of course he did. There's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. You ready? Get your pens out and your notebooks. Here we go. One, question why 9/11 Commission report didn't list one of the main causes of the attacks as bad karma. A lot of people believe that. Two, have definition of rape expanded to include ogling, checking out, sizing up, and looking in the general direction of. Three, add Abu Musab al-Zakari to your Heroes of the Oppressed photo collage. Heavy, man.
These guys have been eating those cupcakes. You
Four,
can tell.
Have marijuana legalized as a treatment for depression, weight loss, and weekdays. The old symptom of, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. I'm against the use of airplanes as a terrorist weapon because of the horrific waste of fossil fuels.
Thank you. In the next hour of Morning Sedition, Mark Maron's Dream Diary, a look at the 9/11 Commission's last public hearing, and Recovery Corner, all coming up here on Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron here along with Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, we're going to talk with 9/11 widower Stephen Push about the end of the 9/11 hearings. We're going to crack open my dream diary, reveal the contents of today's presidential daily briefing, and gently escort George W. into Recovery Corner. That's all coming up. Right now, I'm joined by Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good
nice
morning.
To see you guys. We just got an email from a trucker out there in the world. He says that, Jim, he's a trucker driving through Pennsylvania, says that the trucker who called up does not represent other truckers. He says, I'm praying for Paul Johnson daily. Well, thanks for your email, and I love that.
The other trucker said that Paul Johnson deserved whatever was coming to him because basically he'd gone to Saudi Arabia.
The other trucker was strung out on meth, I think. But I'm sitting here saying it's an email. Yeah, he emailed us from the cab of his truck. It was
he
a call.
He might have a BlackBerry.
It was a call. That's too much. And I'm talking about going to dinner at Mario Batali. Is it Batali?
I think it's Batali.
It's one of his restaurants. I'm going to Luna tonight. Lupa. I'm excited because my wife's in town. We're going to go out for the fancy dinner. And I asked you, here's where I was going with that. Yeah, I asked you if you had ever seen a show on the Food Channel. You're like, you don't watch the Food Channel. It's so weird because I love watching the Food Channel because to me, on some level, the Food Channel is like the only pure television. You know what I mean? Because, you know, it's not distracted.
Reality TV.
Yeah, there's no, like, exactly. Yeah. And it's not short. There's no shortage of subplots or narrative on the Food Channel. Like when the guy goes, all right, we're gonna put these onions aside for later. It's like, really? I wonder what's going to happen with those onions.
I do watch the Food Channel when, what's his name? Emeril. Because he's got good bands.
I used to like him at the beginning, but then it sort of got like, all right, I get it. Bam! Okay,
I only watch till the band finishes playing, and then I switch to something else. I don't stay for the recipe. Because he uses all the, you know, pig entrails and all that. I don't need any of that.
He's a purist, man. He's not afraid of the butter.
Pure pig entrails?
A lot of people, who would use that now? But he's not afraid to use the real stuff. You know, obviously we're shifting gears from the rest of the week where we had many a conversation and confrontation about religion in the United States. I was being criticized as being a Christian basher, and I think it's become clear to you people who listen to me regularly that's not what I'm doing. I am very critical of the extreme right in this country. Religious extremism within the United States is a tremendous concern of mine. And I'd like to quote a couple of people, and I'd like you to guess who these are, if you would. On the dogmas of religion, as distinguished from moral principles, all mankind from the beginning of the world to this day have been quarreling, fighting, burning, and torturing one another for abstractions unintelligible to themselves and to all others and absolutely beyond the comprehension of the human mind. You know who said that?
God.
Derek Jeter. I don't know.
Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson? Yeah. Not George Jefferson. You sure?
Oh, one Peter of the Jeffersons.
Back? Uh-oh.
Wait a minute. Are we going to do this?
I guess we are.
He heard us talking to him. Oh, okay. All right, Peter, we have another trucker on the phone who is going to put his two cents into this. We are now a switchboard for trucker conversation.
Air Truck Network.
Is this me?
He's
That's
not
you.
A trucker.
Okay.
Okay, Peter, what's going on? Peter in Pennsylvania.
Apropos what you just said, Thomas Jefferson also said what we needed in this country was a bloody revolution every 20 years.
Right.
I think people ought to remember that.
But wait, but not coming from the religious extremist, hopefully.
Right. Well, you know what? When they were talking about Michael Moore's film the other night on television, they say, hey, this guy has said some really crazy things. Well, the conservatives love Thomas Jefferson, and you don't pull that one statement out and say, so therefore everything Thomas Jefferson said was irrelevant.
Right. But
I'm a truck driver. I don't think you should come down so hard on the truck driver, because what he's saying is it's basically a Faustian bargain.
Right.
I mean,
no.
In this country, it's extremely repressive. They're killing people. And it's very dangerous there, especially for Americans.
Right, but
it's true. But the hypocrisy is really with the connection between the two governments. And I just think that you can go and think that you might be exposing yourself to some kind of risk in a foreign country, but just his leap was just too extreme to say that simply because he'd gone to earn money in Saudi Arabia that he deserved everything that was coming to him.
Nothing
was really appalling.
Nothing deserves. I'm just saying it's part of the risk he undertook, and it's part of the money. I mean, they're saying, look, you don't have to do the killing, you don't have to do the torturing, but you help us in another way, so we'll have time to do that to our own people.
Yeah, well, you'll help us in the way of creating helicopters that make it easier for people to kill people.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
I understand, but to not have empathy in any way for an American in captivity is a little harsh.
Yeah, maybe if he hadn't referred to him as an SOB, we might have had more. We might have listened to him.
I mean,
like
I think that
was... What's it, 4 o'clock in the morning in L.A., right?
Yeah. Everybody's an SOB in L.A. at 4 o'clock in the morning.
I kind of got the feeling that it was kind of timeless in his cab.
By the way, I got to figure that most truckers must be really, really, I mean, on the one hand, you're listening on the satellite. On the other hand, you got a cell phone. I guess you must have some kind of a, you know, a hands-free device.
And truckers are, keep that 18-wheeler on the road.
Truckers are really hooked up these days.
Do you got a TV in your cab, dude?
They're, in fact, octopuses.
And they got their wife in the cab, too.
Yeah, and you got the sweeping car, and you got, are there TVs?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. DVDs, too.
So you're not driving today?
I've seen whole apartments in there. I've seen a
jacuzzis?
Kitchen and everything.
Any jacuzzis?
We can only hope.
Hey, Peter, thanks for calling. Certainly appreciate your sentiments.
Yes.
Of all the animosities which have existed among mankind, those which are caused by difference of sentiments and religion appear to be the most inveterate, is that the word?
Yes.
And distressing and ought most to be deprecated. I was in hopes that the enlightened and liberal policy which has marked the present age would at least have reconciled Christians of every denomination so far that we should never again see the religious disputes carried to such a pitch as to endanger the peace of society. You know who said that?
Ben Franklin?
George Washington.
Oh, close.
So what's in the news, buddy? Where are we starting?
Well... The Al-Qaeda videotape, the Al-Qaeda training camp videotape, showing people exercising, shooting off guns, taking target practice, and whatever else terrorists do.
Aha, so much for Bush's assertion that there's no longer a terrorist training
factory.
Or whatever he called it.
Well, yeah. Most of it has been outsourced to Iraq. It wasn't there before the war in Iraq, but most of the terrorists have terrorist creation and terrorist activity has been outsourced to Iraq.
Now, here's my question.
Yes.
They show this. They obviously put this thing out for wide dissemination. Does this mean that they are now in the process of you know, creating yet another terrorist attack somewhere in the world? Is that what this video, they're not doing this by accident.
I think that, you know, I see what you're saying. I think what they're saying is, you know, the terrorists are presenting this, not unlike the videos that you see with Nick Berg or the video of the new guy in Saudi Arabia who's presenting himself as the new king terrorist guy.
Yeah.
I think they are basically saying, we're here, you haven't stopped us, we're still training, we're still doing what we need to do, and we're doing it right under your nose.
Right.
And the big question is like, how much of the Taliban is still in place in Afghanistan? What's really going on in Afghanistan? You know, once the war in Iraq started and he moved troops from Afghanistan to, you know, do the Iraq thing because he could.
Mm-hmm.
Because he could. Why'd you do it? Because he could. They were there because I could. That's the kind of transgression that this president is capable of. You see, they ran a guy out of office or tried to because he could have sex with an intern. But on the other hand, this president, because he could, move troops from Afghanistan, where the war wasn't finished, where the job wasn't done, into Iraq because he wanted to. And he lied about the reason of that war, and he continues to lie about connections between Saddam Hussein and terrorists because he can. Yet no one is impeaching this president for his transgression, and I think it's much more heinous. At least the transgression that Bill Clinton did might have, you know, it might have probably ended the life of about millions of potential people on the blue dress. But this guy actually ended American lives and Iraqi lives because he could, yet no one's wanting to impeach this guy. All right. So we'll be back after the break to flesh out the news. Apparently I got lost in a little...
No, I couldn't have said it better, man. That was perfect.
I bloviated. We'll be back on Air America Radio. Yes! Angus! Good morning. I'm sorry for you people who are just having your first cup of coffee. I'm calm. I just had a little moment of excitement about an AC/DC song that was important to me when I was younger. I have Mark Riley here. I have Sue Alcott here this morning. Sedition on Air America Radio. It is 18 past the hour. It is time for me to... I'm breathing heavily into the mic because I think it's... I don't know why. There's something in my head that's making me go...
You think it's turning on Mark Riley and me?
No, I've given up trying
You've
to turn
on
you
that.
On a long time ago.
But
you know, that was like maybe the first couple of days, and I realized, wow, no access here, and I stopped. So
it's always good to keep it professional.
it's looking for... Anyway, here we go. The thing is, it's now time for my dream diary. Yeah, I just got all of that stuff out yesterday to my therapist. And then, of course, I go home last night. Here we go. It's Salem 1692, I'm in a courtroom surrounded by angry white people in black frock coats. This big, ugly Puritan who looks like Cheney stares down at me from the bench and says, "Kneel, witch! Thy brazen harlotry shames this holy tribunal." I'm looking around for a witch, and then I realize I'm wearing a long black skirt and a bonnet. Damn, why do I always have to be the witch, I think. Someone whacks me on the back of the knees with a stick. "Witch, hast thou spoken against thy God over the airwaves to the multitude?" I say, "First of all, look, my name is Mark, and I didn't really speak against God. It's just that all those Puritans out there, no offense, I think that they all think I hate religion." "Be silent, witch! We accuse thee of sorcery, cavorting with demons and unnatural coupling with Harry Potter, boy wizard of Hogwarts." Right then, Jesus comes into the courtroom and says, "Mark doesn't cavort with demons. All his demons are personal. 15 years of psychotherapy standing right here." "Be silent, Jew," Cheney says. I say, "Hey, look, you can't talk to Jesus that way." But just then, a Puritan with no teeth screams, "Dunk the witch in the lake! If she floats, the witch be Satan's whore. If she sinks, the witch be a child of God." So a mob of Puritans drag me out back and toss me in. Luckily, I'm saved by a gang of amphibious mermen who live underwater and work for Jesus. They swim me to safety. I grow gills, turn green, and become one of them. I swim to Barbados, and I minister to Christian merfolk. I woke up, and my bed was filled with unbending dogma.
Uh-oh.
Powerful. So now, okay, see, I'm breathing. I'm doing this breathing thing. I'm just trying to breathe. I'm doing a new yoga.
I'm doing yoga.
So now, okay, the Bush administration, the Bush machine, the Republican machine tried to characterize, you know, Cheney as a flip-flopper, tried to characterize him
Kerry.
They tried to characterize Kerry as a flip-flopper. They tried to characterize him as a guy who was anti-American, anti-veteran, a confused, you know, war protester. And now it's pessimism. Now they're trying to characterize, you know, Kerry, it's being a little negative. Being a little negative about the economy. He doesn't understand that we created 1.3 million jobs. He also understands, I think Kerry understands, that you're still in the hole.
A deep hole.
Yeah. I mean, you still didn't make up for the jobs that were lost under your administration.
Well, the president says that the economy has shifted into a higher gear, which is, you know, like, I guess maybe like going from first to second when you were in fifth to start with.
Right.
And he's now saying that, look, you know, the economy's starting to turn around. You know, people here in New York are starting to say New York City's economy, which is traditionally slower than the rest of the country, that's starting to turn around. And what I guess this means is two things. One, it is a tacit admission that the economy was in the dumpster to begin with.
Yeah.
Which he never really came out and said, but now he's shifting into a higher gear. The other thing that is hypocritical about this,
yes,
is the fact that in 2000, George W. Bush ran against the best economy in America during the entire 20th century, for God's sake.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Under Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton created 7.7 million new jobs in the first 34 months of his administration and upwards of 20 million during the course of his presidency.
What he doesn't say, of course, is that the jobs are picking up in New York. Rich people's jobs are picking up in New York. High-end Wall Street jobs. People's BlackBerries are ringing with headhunters and companies, and big Wall Street firms are expanding and taking people back on that they laid off a few years ago. And real estate is still crazy. But people who need lower-income jobs are still not getting benefits, and they're not getting vacation, and they're getting sometimes below the minimum wage. There's an interesting lawsuit by the Attorney General of New York, Elliot Spitzer, who is suing temp agencies because too many people who need jobs and are desperate for jobs are being funneled through these temp agencies into companies that don't pay benefits and pay below minimum wage. And he hasn't had any success in busting the companies, so now he's taken over the last week a new tactic to directly sue the temp agencies. That is not a flourishing economy in the New York area.
Well, also, as we spoke to Robert Reich, he said a lot of the new jobs that were created were these, you know, sort of not great jobs, not health coverage jobs, a lot of service sector jobs.
Hinky jobs. Jobs that really don't allow you to feed your family. What ends up happening, and I think this is being duplicated across the country, people are now working two and a half, three. You remember that In Living Color segment when they used to have that family, the Headleys, and everybody had five jobs?
So you did watch television at some point in time, Mark,
in the 90s, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I mean,
they weren't that long ago.
That's the economy that we're starting to see. In order for a couple with a couple of children in many areas of this country, certainly not just in New York City, go out to Ohio, you see the same thing. They've got to have a job at Walmart, and then they work part-time doing security for someplace else. And they're trying to cobble together the kinds of, and in many cases it means that they then have to pay huge amounts of money in daycare costs because nobody's home to watch
and that's,
the kids.
And that's counted as a job. Did you know? Robert Reich talks about this, about the gross economic, the gross numbers, gross, what is it? What's it?
Gross National Product, GNP. GNP.
Yeah. I think it's a GNP, but he says that the way this stuff works, when you have people who are holding two jobs, yeah, and you have people who are married to people who are holding two jobs, and they're paying someone to watch your kids, some of these people are within the service sector themselves. They're watching someone else's kids, and they're getting a certain amount of money, and then they got to go home and pay the person that's watching
their kids. Yeah.
And all that movement of money counts.
Yes.
As movement of money, yet it doesn't. It's not really moving anywhere. It's not helping those people. Those people don't have health coverage. They don't have, you know, they don't have any guarantees that their jobs are secure.
And you know what else they don't have? They don't have hope that this situation is going to change. You know, people that work two jobs don't intend on working two jobs for 40 years. All right. Eventually they figure, okay, I will move up the economic ladder and I'll be able to just work one regular 35-hour, 40-hour week job. Well, more and more people now are starting to move into their late 20s and early 30s and realize that the hope to be able to do that, the hope of advancing up the ladder, is suddenly not there for them anymore.
But
they can't hold on to the hope of that. Robert Reich is going to be on Monday.
Monday, yeah.
And I can't wait to ask him about this stuff because I read his book and I got in trouble with some of our listeners for sort of not being more, you know, forward and prodding with Thomas Friedman when we had him on about outsourcing. And I want to talk to Robert Reich about outsourcing because this is a real issue to Americans that all their jobs are going overseas. And these people who are economic theorists or people who are, you know, paying attention to the economy say that jobs are going to be available if the education and the focus on the types of jobs that are going to be available is done. And I'm not sure that holds true. And I really am interested in finding that stuff out.
But there's a big reason why Bush is going after Kerry on this economy and job stuff now. And that is that there's concern that many Americans are becoming less connected to the news in Iraq and that polls show that people are maybe being hardened to the events over there and not paying such close attention. Once they shift their attention from Iraq, what's the thing they're going to be looking at? The economy and jobs, because those are the two issues in this campaign.
But the beautiful thing about
the economy and war. I mean, if Bush could turn around and blame Kerry for the weather, he would do it.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about the economy is no matter how much they focus on or whatever they may say, it's still going to come down to a guy going, how much money I got? Damn!
Yep. Yep.
I want that guy out. So no matter how much lip service they pay to it, ultimately it's going to come down to people's pocketbooks. But the fear of Iraq being pushed to the back burner with this handover is definitely frightening. And it's going to require a fairly diligent press corps and a fairly, you know, honest amount of time on our part to make sure this stuff stays in the news and the truth gets out there.
But also, and Bush's credibility on the Iraq stuff is going to be damaged, most especially this week with the findings from 56% the 9/11 Commission.
56% approval rating on terrorists.
So if he doesn't look good on the Iraq stuff, then he has to start kind of trying to build up his reputation on the economy, and it doesn't pan out.
But his credibility is faltering with us. Whether it falters with people who are following this guy and who believe in his ability to stay strong, that's a whole other question. There's still a 56% approval rating of his fighting the war on terrorism, and absolutely no evidence that he's winning anything. There's evidence that it's getting worse. So your optimism, I hope, is true. I hope that, you know, honestly, that people start seeing that there is no connection between Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that all this stuff is just being repeated, so they believe a certain thing. But there's been no indication that the majority of the American people are not falling for this.
But you know what, though?
Kerry has to get out there with credibility somehow in his message. Credibility.
But you know what? That same polling does not say that the American people are on the bus about the economy specifically. Terror, yes. But despite all of this rosy news, despite this, the economy's kicking into high gear, people are not buying that.
No,
they're not.
No, I wasn't saying that they were. I'm just saying why it is that Bush is going on that issue.
Oh,
so
no,
hard.
I agree with you there.
Because he's desperate. He needs it. I mean, it's a close race. It's a core issue for him, as is the war on terrorism. And doesn't matter. It's all about he'll carry on with his message, flying in the face of details and flying in the face of evidence on the economy.
In the face of truth.
Exactly in the same way as he has on the links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
Well, stay the course in the face of truth.
That's right. Stay the course. Straight ahead, the presidential daily briefing. 9/11 victim family member Stephen Push assesses the work of the commission. And later, guess who's the dog of the week? Keep listening to Air America Radio.
Good morning. Friday. It's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. This is Mark Riley. Stu Ellicott is here. This is Air America Radio. Man, I was watching the CNN last night. And I was listening to the 9/11 Commission, those tapes of the air traffic controllers and NORAD people. I mean, it really threw a wrench into my, you know, whole conspiratorial nature. You know, the fact of the matter was these cats were just not prepared, man. They had no idea how to handle the situation. And by the time anybody was willing to pull the trigger on these planes, it was done.
That's the interesting thing, is coming out, you know, Bush trying to say that he's the best person to lead the world and lead America in the war against terror. You know, there's the reports that have come out of the 9/11 Commission, especially yesterday, show that there was a widespread confusion, actually, on the morning of 9/11.
To the point where
Cheney gave orders without even consulting Bush. He may have acted on his own.
Well, that's what Cheney said, that he was given orders by the president who he gave the orders to.
That's true, yeah. Did you have trouble listening to that, though?
It was painful.
It was listening to whoever it was on the plane talk about we're going back to the... I could only listen to that once.
It was painful.
Listen to it more than once.
I couldn't... The horrible... These people that were like, I don't know what to do. And then the people on the plane, just thinking about what they were going through at that moment, you know when your brain just blossoms into terrifying, you know, just like that feeling of like, like complete anxiety and sadness?
Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the most kind of painful and kind of wrenching of information that the American public has had to deal with since actually seeing the images on 9/11. I think it brought a whole aspect to the terror attacks alive in a very, you know, threatening and troubling way yesterday.
And this is going to get back to, for me, a central question that came out of September 11th that the commission is not going to deal with, and that the American people, I think, have actually put behind us at this point. What exactly, and Randy is the only person I know who deals, Randy Rhodes.
Right.
What exactly did this guy do? And I'm talking about the president now. Exactly what did he do when he knew that the country was under attack?
He read to kids.
I know, and that's troubling.
The weird thing was is that, like, you know, he thought there's statements coming out now that he said he wanted to look strong for the nation. He wanted to remain strong. In his head, remaining strong was to act like nothing was going on, or to try to act like, you know, it's just a casual event, whereas the proper response would have been like, hey, you know, I got to go. Deal with this.
I mean, I'm sure his first thought was, where the heck is Cheney? Get me him on the phone ASAP.
I think the first thought was, is somebody going to take care of this?
I'm beginning to wonder, because if you listen very carefully, those of you who've never had a chance, listen to Franklin Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor. And listen to how composed he was, how focused he was. Exactly. He said, look, this was a day of infamy. This will not stand. We're going to war over this. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. I didn't hear.
Let me put a little crackle behind it.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't hear that kind of focused leadership out of George W. Bush for a day, and maybe it was because he was trying to get the bin Ladens out of the country without any problems.
That's right. They got him up in the air, and they're like, where do we put the president? And didn't they fly to Louisiana
first? They flew to a couple of places, yeah, before. I think they did fly to Louisiana, actually. There did not seem to be that kind of focus. Now, maybe this is entirely excusable for most Americans. Maybe people think, well, you know, he was shook up, he was upset, he was angry, whatever. But I think, Mark, what you said a minute ago is crucial.
Yeah.
He wanted to look strong,
yes.
Not be strong.
Yeah,
look strong.
I can't
wait to see Michael.
Doing.
I can't wait to see Michael Moore's movie. I mean, because like this is going to really show a side of this president that people have not really seen. They can only assume. How do you think the 9/11 Commission did in its findings? Call us up. We're at 866-303-2270, 866-303-AAR0. We're trying to get Stephen Plush on the phone to talk to him. You can email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Talk to you in a minute. Good morning, it's Mark Maron. It's Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio. Sue is doing a weird pointing dance. Mark Riley is here.
That's yoga.
It was a dance.
Oh, okay.
That was a British person pretending like she has rhythm. Now,
you better not tell Jazzy B that.
That's where it all started. The white people know rhythm.
Yeah.
Jews have rhythm. My producer just shouted in my head, this from the Jew. The Jews have rhythm, my friend.
Yeah, and great food.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that British is anybody to talk about food. I mean, if there's one thing worse than Jewish food, it's those weird British pasty cakes with corn cooked in them and potatoes.
Hey,
what about the Gershwin brothers?
Oops, here we go. The Gershwin brothers were beautiful. Here we go. Presidential Daily Briefing. It's time to take a look at our highly classified top secret document that crosses George W. Bush's desk every morning. Today's PDB from the intelligence community. Al-Qaeda has training camp. Note, this is a new PDB. Mr. President, it's come to our attention that Al-Qaeda has reestablished a training camp in Afghanistan. It came to our attention because they released a videotape showing that Al-Qaeda has reestablished a training camp in Afghanistan. As you may recall, we invaded them 2 years ago with the express goal of getting rid of Al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan. The fact that the camp may actually be in Pakistan offers little comfort. It's in the same time zone, and it's an Al-Qaeda training camp. The fact that they exist is embarrassing. The fact that Al-Qaeda is confident enough to release promotional videotapes and are on the verge of hiring image consultants is extremely embarrassing. I don't have to tell you what a blow it would be if Al-Qaeda decided to sponsor a NASCAR driver. Our recommendation is simple. Destroy Al-Qaeda. We recommend that 3 years ago, both before and after September 11th, but you decided it was more important to divert all our resources to Iraq. So who cares what we say? Respectfully, Office of Homeland Security. I know I got a lot of callers waiting to talk. We have our guest with us, so you're going to have to wait or call back.
Wait,
because he'd like to take some questions as well. On Thursday, as you know, the 9/11 Commission issued its findings as it held the final public session of a momentous review of the worst terror strikes in the nation's history. The panel is expected to make a final report next month into the events that killed nearly 3,000 people, and that's coming out on July 26th. Today we have Stephen Push, whose wife was killed on 9/11. Good morning, sir. What do you think of the hearings? Did they resolve anything for you?
Well, we got a lot of new detail yesterday on the nature of the FAA's failures and the NORAD's failures to protect the country. The day before that, we got a lot more detail on how Al-Qaeda planned the attacks. But the overall theme hasn't really changed. We've known for a long time now that many government agencies failed us on 9/11, intelligence, aviation security, border control and others.
Right, they were definitely not doing their jobs. They were not prepared. You could clearly tell that from the tapes we heard yesterday.
Yes, it was very disturbing that FAA officials claimed that there was no way they could have conceived of such an attack happening, when we know that the intelligence agencies had much information. Some of it in the public record.
Had the PDB,
certainly. That something like that could happen.
Now, what as a family member, as a husband in this situation, I mean, what's the conclusion? What would you like to see happen?
Well, we were instrumental in getting the law passed to create the commission. You may recall that President Bush opposed any investigation for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we felt the commission was important is that we feel that major changes need to be made in intelligence and border control and other areas and aviation security to make the country more secure in the future, to prevent something like this from happening again. Initially, the country was in denial, and officials were saying, well, we did nothing wrong, you know, we couldn't have anticipated this. Now we see a very different story now that the reports are coming out from the commission. And we know that there are things that could have been done better. And it's beginning to be we've seen some movement or some change in attitudes that encourages me that there will be major reforms coming after this report.
Stephen Push, 9/11 victim family member. I was curious that this commission took a year and a half. It had just about 1,000 witnesses, 2 million pages of documents reviewed. The report is due out July 26th. Are you afraid, in an effort not to look partisan, this commission is going to dilute its conclusions about who was responsible for the lapses that led to September 11th?
Well, the main goal of the commission is not to point a finger at particular individuals. There's plenty of blame to go around here. There are many agencies and many individuals involved. And you may have noticed that quietly and sometimes not so quietly, some of these officials have left their positions for various purported reasons, but I think there has been some house cleaning done as a result of the failures of 9/11 already. But the main reason is not to hang someone out to dry. It is to understand what went wrong. It was a broad systemic failure across the whole government, and we really need to understand what went wrong so that we can fix the problems. I'm more interested in the structural and systemic remedies that they're going to propose. For example, do we need to have a director of national intelligence? We now have 15 different intelligence agencies, many of whom don't speak to each other, and no one in charge, no single person in charge who can hold them accountable. Does that need to change? Do we need to have a domestic intelligence organization similar to MI5 in Britain? Because it appears that the FBI has a conflict. On the one hand, it sees itself as a criminal investigation agency. On the other hand, it's trying to do domestic intelligence work, and those two missions often seem to be in conflict with one another. So these are the kinds of issues that need to be addressed. We need to have an independent, bipartisan body give us their best advice on and how the country needs to move forward, and then we need to have either executive orders or legislation that will implement those changes.
Stephen Push, you lost your wife aboard the plane that crashed into the Pentagon on 9/11, and you've done an enormous amount of research and followed very closely the commission, 9/11 Commission's hearings, and know lots of details about intelligence. What do you think is realistically the best thing that can come out of this? You've told us what your hopes are, but what do you think really will happen?
Well, for example, I mentioned the idea of a director of national intelligence. I think something along those lines needs to be done. I think that we need to have one person who has authority over the intelligence community, whether it's a new position called director of national intelligence or whether we elevate the position of director of central intelligence to that level where they don't have to be involved with the day-to-day running of the CIA, but they're looking at the total picture. I think that's essential to get these agencies to communicate with one another and cooperate with one another. I think the idea of some type of domestic intelligence agency is necessary. Whether it's in the FBI or outside the FBI is to me not as important as to whether within that organization there is sufficient funding and stature in the organization for them to do a good job. Right now they're playing second fiddle to a criminal investigation organization that doesn't really reward the kinds, that rewards people who solve cases, mm-hmm. doesn't reward people who prevent terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen Push. I really appreciate it, and sorry for your trouble.
Thank you.
Yep.
Take care.
We're taking your calls at 866-303-2270. We got a lot of you on hold. Thank you for holding. We're gonna try and get to as many as possible after this break. So come back. Morning, Mark Maron here. Morning's edition. Sue Ellicott, Mark Riley,
hey.
Air America Radio. I'm Mark, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. In recovery corner, I reach out to fellow 12-steppers who are struggling to stay clean and sober. Today, as always, I'm offering my sponsorship to my temporary sponsee, George W. Now, look, George, I think we'd all agree that the 9/11 Commission is doing some important work. One of the most important things they've done that directly affects you, George, is they took your inventory for you. They announced if there were intelligence failures, there were no weapons of mass destruction, no ties to Al-Qaeda, no warm welcomes from Iraqis. I know this is all hard to hear, but you needed to hear it, buddy, because I think we can both agree that you do not do personal inventories. All right, George, listen, buddy. You got to surrender, all right? You got to surrender and honor your disease. This 9/11 Commission should have spurred you into action. Maybe it's time you read the book. All right, and I'm not talking about the hungry caterpillar, all right? Pick up the big book, George, and pull yourself out of this shame spiral. You're not just dragging yourself down, buddy. You're also pulling down all of your codependents. And I don't think I have to tell you that your codependency numbers are down to 49%. And that's a soft 49%, all right? Hey, the number's even worse among independent codependents. So take a hard look at you, George. Or a bipartisan commission will do it for you. Remember, denial is not a river in Egypt. Sobriety is a journey, not a destination. Humility is our acceptance of ourselves. Get to a meeting. Don't drink. Here we go. Adam in New Jersey. What's up, buddy?
Hey, Adam.
Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for having me on. My big concern right now is really more about the country's stress level than anything else.
Okay.
I lead a fairly high-stress lifestyle, and I interact with many, many different types of people in different situations at different levels of stressful conditions.
So you're like a stress professional. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But basically what my concern is I was under the impression that this was my own self-doing, that I brought this on myself and that this is kind of why I live in a stressful condition.
Right.
And my family condition would probably also contribute to that. But the more I talk to people in the general population in different whether they're wealthy
yes.
or not wealthy or, you know, set up with
right.
inheritance or not, everyone seems to be operating on a level of stress that is almost incompatible with quality of life.
We're freaked out, man. We got a president that freaks us out. Every time he decides he wants to, he just makes us more afraid.
And I think that what's really being absent, what's really just not being pushed or at least communicated is that, you know, this level of uncertainty and the politics of fear, as you guys are very good at explaining, is really contributing to everyone's stress level besides the fact that people are working harder for less money and besides the fact that we really don't know what the next 4 years are going to bring. And I'm at a point right now that if it truly is the central government that's generating this, I don't know if we're going to survive another 4 years.
Just an unstressful, everyone's just going to explode.
Gee, thanks for sharing. We're not going to make it through the next 4 years?
Ooh. I don't even know what that was. It was supposed to be something else, but Adam, that was very well articulated. Nancy in Yonkers. Nancy?
Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I didn't realize that you were getting to me.
Yes, ma'am.
You guys are great. I love you. I listen to you all day at work, mm-hmm. and I'm the only cubicle that is laughing like everyone else. Because I listen on headphones.
Oh, good.
I wanted to make a comment about Bush at the something Booker school.
The school.
You can look at that whole video online if you go look for it.
Uh-huh.
And he does not look like he's in charge. He does not look like he knows what to do. He looks
freaked out.
Scared.
Yeah.
He That's because
really
he was.
Scared. And I think Michael Moore has done a great service by putting us in his movie.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
My husband and I have been saying, anybody who sees that knows this man is not in charge.
Did you see the movie already?
No, but I
She's seen the footage.
I understand that he focuses on that in the movie.
Oh, yeah. Great. Well, thanks for your call. I think you're absolutely right. We were talking about that before the show today. Our producer, Jonathan, was talking about how he was like, he just looked terrified.
Who, me?
Yeah.
I'm president?
Maryland and New Jersey.
I think you're all great, and I just want to make two or three comments.
Okay.
First of all, the air traffic controllers, wasn't it disclosed about 2 or 3 weeks ago that the tape had been destroyed?
We'll look into it.
FAA? FAA stuff?
Well, and that it had been deposited in various trash cans after it was cut up. And
I don't know anything about that.
Know about it is Randy Rhodes. Ask her.
Yeah, well, we can get some information. People write in when somebody brings up questions like that.
Yeah, or else we're going to have a segment called Ask Randy in this show.
Yeah, she I guess she didn't finish her other points. That was our fault. Sorry if we disconnected you too soon.
But, you know, the whole idea that there were questions about, and I heard this during some of the testimony in front of the commission, there were questions about whether or not NORAD in particular shared a lot of the information that they, in fact, had with the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission asked them for a whole bunch of stuff, including some tapes. NORAD's people came back and said, well, sorry, we don't know about any tapes, and then tapes turned up.
Yeah,
right.
I think they got them at the second. They did show up later, didn't they?
Yeah, well, they did show up
later. Isn't that interesting? You mean within this political climate, this administration, that something would be held secret until they were called on it and pressed to the wall?
Busted, I think, is the word.
And they weren't able to displace the blame or make the tapes disappear somewhere else?
Nope. They ended up having to give them up, and then they were put in the embarrassing position yesterday of explaining how a set of tapes they originally told the commission did not exist turned up, and they listened to them.
Yeah.
Interesting. In the final hour of Morning's Edition, television's Harry Thomason talks about his movie, The Hunting of the President, the presidential palm pilot, plus the countdown to democracy and the dog of the week. This is Air America Radio.
I'm Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Yay! The week is over. The week is definitely over. It's Friday. It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. I'm with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. We've got Harry Thomason.
Hey!
Coming up. He's going to be here. He's a friend of Bill Clinton's, of course, and it's we're going to talk about the new movie about Bill Clinton. Plus, we've got the president's palm pie with the liberal agenda and our countdown to democracy. That's all coming up. You know, I'm looking at some emails here. Can we see if this thing works? Does this work?
Game over, man. Game over.
There it is. It's only the third time I hit it. Now I had to do it out of context just to see if it worked.
Well, there you have it.
Man, I wish that, you know, this studio, sometimes I think it's being run like the Flintstone machines, you know, like there's a little prehistoric bird on a treadmill.
That's not right. It. It's ghosts.
Oh, is that what it
is? It's ghosts.
We got ghost problems in the studio?
The
you
ghosts
know about them.
Of past DJs.
Right. He's been here for a while. He's seen
right.
That come and go.
I've seen them walk.
Here we go. Email from a guy named Sean, New Hampshire. Great show. Keep fighting the good fight. Anyway, I do not think the 9/11 Commission has any credibility. King George handpicked every member of the commission, so I find it unlikely that they will expose the true wrongdoing done between the Bushes and Sauds. One major instance of wrongdoing is when Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, and George Tenet were meeting with General Mahmoud Ahmad, then the head of the Pakistani ISI. Ahmad was on an official visit from September 4th through 13th, 2001. Just before 9/11, General Ahmad sent a $100,000 wire transfer to Mohammed Atta.
Oops.
Yeah, I believe that the Bush administration should be forced to explain why they were with one of the people who funded the September 11th attacks. You know, the truth of the matter is that George Bush keeps claiming that there's a connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. There may have been meetings, and there may have been terrorism up in the no-fly zone in northern Iraq, but there was no active connection because Saddam turned them away. But arguably, there's probably more a stronger connection between the Bush family and George W. with Osama bin Laden than there ever was with Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Just through a Bush family friend, James Bath, Salam bin Laden, that was Osama's older brother, helped bail out Harkin Energy. And that was a struggling Texas oil company that was headed by who? George W. Bush. In the mid-90s, Salam bin Laden and the Saudi bin Laden group became the business associates with former President George H.W. Bush and former Secretary of State Satan James Baker by investing in the Carlyle Group. And the Carlyle Group is filled with Bush family members.
Wait, hold up. The Carlyle Group.
Yes.
The Carlyle Group.
Yes.
Bin Laden.
Yes.
Carlyle.
Yes.
Think about that for a minute.
Yep.
The Carlyle Group is one of the most influential groups, not in America.
In the world.
On planet Earth.
They're a group of investors and big money brokers. It includes John Major's part of the Carlyle Group. Mm-hmm. There's a whole cast of characters. I remember right after 9/11, because I read an article about the Carlyle Group in the New York Times, and I tracked down their website, and you could just see the cast of characters there. And within weeks, it was, you know, the website was pulled.
Could just backtrack a little bit to the listener's email saying that he didn't really believe that the 9/11 Commission was going to have any teeth, basically. Well, he's wrong based on their declaration yesterday that there was no solid link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, because that presents a big problem for George Bush, and it undermines his credibility on one of the major issues on which he went to war. So on that alone, the 9/11 Commission is no patsy.
Well, I think what he's saying is that they've been not allowed to investigate. There's a lot of conspiracies, and there's a lot of, you know, facts and points that they may have investigated that we don't know about. We haven't gotten the whole thing. And what you're saying is true, but, you know, Bush is, you know, strongly denying it and continuing to, you know, to stay the course in the face of evidence, truth, and everything to the contrary.
I think it's good if they're seen as, you know, somewhat kind of weak and unlikely to be incendiary and kind of anti-Bush or, you know, pro any particular political party. Because when they do come out with their report, which is due when? July 26th?
Yes.
They'll be taken very seriously. And that, you know, what the findings that we've had so far have only looked bad for Bush.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I hope that the approval ratings continue to drop. I hope that people see that the war on terrorism is not being won by this president, and they think that they are. And I hope that everybody goes to see Michael Moore's movie. Whatever you think about Michael Moore, you know, this is a lot of that information. That some of it's taken from Craig Unger's book. And the Michael Moore movie should really flesh out some of these connections, because this is important information that hasn't been, you know, manipulated. And it's truth. And a lot of people who refuse to see truth, you know, are blinded by this administration.
Well, the 9/11 panel is, I think, going to issue a report that is going to have as its central point that it is not a partisan situation. The people who were opposed to this commission in the first place did a really, really good job in retrospect in putting the commission in a corner, going after Jamie Gorelick, I believe that's her name, the commissioner, you know, kind of putting them in a partisan corner, even though the chair of the commission is none other than Tom Kaine, a Republican former governor of New Jersey. The bottom line is they always, the Bush supporters always questioned how partisan this is. And I think the report that you're going to see in July is going to reflect the fact that they don't want to be seen as Bush bashers, but they almost can't help themselves. You know, this contradiction between what the panel says about the connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda and what Bush says is not going to go away that fast.
It won't. But the only thing I've seen that could, you know, that does sort of strengthen kind of Bush supporters, or, you know, Mr. Bush's message, is the bit that came out earlier this week that the al-Qaeda leaders had planned a much broader series of attacks, and that they, you know, they're still thinking of doing that, and that plays or could play into Bush's claims that, you know, we are really in an actual war against terror. But it does not strengthen his position that he is the best person to lead us and the rest of the world against it.
Well, the problem here is essentially that there's a lot of people in this country that don't do their homework. I have a hard time doing all the homework. They aren't concerned with the truth of what's going on in the world. They respond to a vibe, to a tone. There's a lot of people that Bush appeals to just because of his arrogance and his bullying nature, that people mistake that as truth. Frighten people specifically in a certain type of person. They don't want to see that, you know, they'll look at anything, any evidence against his presidency as being some sort of democratic spin, some sort of liberal, you know, take on things, and they're just trying to take this guy down who they like. The real thing that needs to happen is somehow or another, people have got to get out in mass numbers and vote against this guy.
It's an interesting kind of bullying, though, isn't it? Because that's the reason he gets away with it is because it's sort of charming, and it's not aggressive and nasty and threatening, as he does it in the kind of all shucks kind of way, and that's part of his, you know, we will stay the course, and we, you know, we are winning.
I don't know if it's all shucks. I think he's smug.
He has a lot of nerve.
Enormous
amount of nerve that he cannot back down, and even in light of the findings from the 9/11 Commission this week, cannot back down and say, you know, we're wrong about the link between al-Qaeda.
I don't think he's like charming in that. I think he's a smug,
not to
arrogant,
you, not to me, not to Mark Riley, but
person.
He's charming.
Not to me, definitely.
No, I see his charm, but I think his bullying is very straight ahead, tough daddy BS.
Well, let's listen to him. Let's hear what he has to say.
His credibility.
Let's hear what he has to say about Saddam Hussein and the threat posed by the former Iraqi dictator.
He's a threat because he was a sworn enemy to the United States of America, just like al-Qaeda. Now, he was a threat because he had terrorist connections, not only al-Qaeda connections, but other connections to terrorist organizations.
I mean, basically, he's saying he was a threat because I said so.
Well, we're gonna take him to task after the break.
Yeah, let's do that.
We're gonna take him to task because we got the proof, we got the evidence right here, and we're gonna do it up. And we got Harry Thomason coming later.
Yes, yes.
Come back. Remain calm. It's Friday, Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. It's Mark Riley. Sue Ellicott is over here.
I'm trying to remain calm.
I'm over here in the corner.
Down, writing on her hand.
With my dunce cap.
On her arm, on her pad. Sue writes all
hand.
Over herself. It's
yeah,
a strange, compulsive behavior from Sue Ellicott over there in the corner. Here's our presidential...
That's just the writing you can see.
Yeah, where else do you write?
Yeah, right.
Weird reminders.
After the break, guys.
Yeah, look, what do you have, reminders? Belly button. Right boob. Okay. Here's the presidential palm pilot downloaded from the presidential palm pilot. Here's the schedule for today for the president, 7 o'clock a.m. Wake up. Stay on message. Saddam definitely had long-standing ties to al-Qaeda. How long do I have to stay on this message? 8 o'clock a.m. Speak to military personnel, Fort Lewis, Washington. Tell them it's great to have an audience that's ordered to listen to you. 12:05 p.m. Fly to Reno. See if I can get a quickie divorce from reality. Grounds, incompatibility. 1 p.m. Stop by Caesar's Palace. Have Bill Bennett play some bets for you. How are you, Bill? 2:20 p.m. Address voters in Reno. Promise them the loosest slots in Washington. 3 p.m. while in Nevada, quietly dump nuclear waste. Why not? 3:30 p.m. Fly back to Washington, D.C. and then Camp David. During the layover, provide leadership. 11:40 p.m. Arrive at Camp David. Smash and smear lightning bugs. Hey, look. Oh, it's gone. Hey, look. Oh, it's gone. 12:30 a.m. Make historic Camp David Accord between graham crackers, chocolate, and marshmallows. Yay.
Yeah.
So let's take it down. What we're going to do, we're going to prove that it was not Saddam Hussein who wanted war.
No, it wasn't. I mean, he may have wanted war with his own people. He may have wanted to gas Kurds.
Bad guy.
He was a bad guy. But he did not really want war with the United States. That was not really on his agenda. That was on someone else's agenda. But again, Chris, do we still have that same sound from the president? Is that still around?
Yeah.
Let's hear the president one more time talking about Saddam.
He's a threat because he was a sworn enemy to the United States of America, just like Al-Qaeda. Now, he was a threat because he had terrorist connections, not only Al-Qaeda connections, but other connections to terrorist organizations.
Well, that was a powerful statement. Let me make sure I understood that. He had Al-Qaeda connections, but also connections to other terrorist organizations.
What other terrorist organizations? Don't dare ask.
But the thing was there were no Al-Qaeda connections. There was, you know, Osama reached out to Saddam, and Saddam said, no, we don't need you. And then Osama called him. I think there's a quote. I have a quote here from Osama called him, like, not even a good Muslim. I had it right here.
Well,
here's
one. I have one quote from Osama from back in 96 when he did declare war on U.S. troops. This is a direct quote from Osama bin Laden, who is either frozen awaiting October or is still on the loose. The presence of the American Crusades armed forces in the countries of the Islamic Gulf is the greatest danger and the biggest harm that threatens the world's largest oil reserves. The infidels must be thrown out of the Arabian Peninsula. Supporters should employ fighting tactics using light and quick moving troops. In other words, launching guerrilla war in which the sons of the nation take part, but not the armed forces.
And that was probably around the time when the Bush administration played right into the fear about the Crusades and the religious component of the war by calling that military operation Operation Just Cause.
Yeah. Hussein is a false Muslim who only worships himself and his ruling Ba'ath Party.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, Saddam himself said in February of 2003, just before America did go to war, Iraq has no interest in war. No Iraqi official or ordinary citizen has expressed a wish to go to war.
And here's some other stuff that just about the connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. At various times, this is David Kay, the former head of the CIA's Iraq Survey Group, and this is June 16, 2004. Recently, that would be very recently.
Yeah.
At various times, Al-Qaeda people came through Baghdad and in some cases resided there, but we simply did not find any evidence of extensive links with Al-Qaeda or, for that matter, any real links at all. Cheney's speech is evidence-free.
But you know what? Blair is having to do the same thing in Britain. You know, he's under fire. He was the U.S.'s major ally in all this, dealing with the same faulty intelligence, trying to convince people that there were weapons of mass destruction, same stuff. Today, there are reports that he's saying that Saddam Hussein created a permissive environment for terrorism. That's the phrase he used. And that we know, the British government know, that the people affiliated to Al-Qaeda operated in Iraq during the regime. They're trying to pull the same scam with the same fuzzy language, flying in the face of the 9/11 Commission, who said they found no credible link, no collaborative relationship. I mean, stuff that's fairly incontrovertible. It's forceful language. It's very clear. It's not okay that the administration here just carries on waffling about ties and contacts and links. If they weren't meaningful, if there was a phone call, if there was a meeting, meetings that were disputed, never proven, that does not stand up.
Yeah, it's like a guy saying, hi, see, we're connected.
Yeah, no, we're
in. He just walked by me.
Yeah, we're dating. We're getting married.
Well, you know, there was that whole thing about, was it Mohammed Atta in the Czech Republic?
Yeah.
That Dick Cheney actually used.
He keeps on talking about that. It's never been proven.
No. As a matter of fact, nobody, I thought they had actually disproved it at a point.
If they've got real evidence of this, you would think that this administration, if any, would like cherish the opportunity to actually support something they say. Well, as opposed to just blaming George Tenet for everything.
I mean, Cheney came out on that meeting that you just mentioned, Mark. He took issue with the commission finding there was no evidence to corroborate reports that an Iraqi intelligence officer met with an operative from Al-Qaeda in Prague.
So it's their word against
it. Yeah, but this is what Cheney said. We have never been able to confirm that, nor have we been able to knock it down. So he keeps on playing into the possibility that maybe it happened. Everybody else is saying it did not.
Yeah, so it's basically they're playing this game. It's like, well, it's your word against the president's and mine.
Exactly.
What are you going to do? Huh, commission? What do you got? Looks like you guys were all done. We're still here.
See, this was, again, a war of opportunity. This was a situation where the administration took the tragedy, the horror of September 11th, and then said, okay, how are we going to use this to further an agenda that has been cooked up by a cabal of people that included Cheney, Rumsfeld, that whole crew in the Defense Department and the neoconservatives.
No.
And they
right.
figured out, okay, if we tie Saddam Hussein, no matter how tenuous the actual ties are, if we can somehow tie Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda and September 11th, which are, for most Americans, one and the same thing.
Because
and Bush knew this.
If they hear it in the same sentence, it's one and the same thing. And they justified it. Where's that presidential note? You know the note that says...
Yes.
This is like the justifications here. This was the text of a letter from the president to the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the president. You know, this is like... You know, this he's trying to lump it together by saying continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th. And that is right after he says reliance by the United States on further diplomatic and other peaceful means alone will neither A, adequately protect the national security of the United States against a continuing threat posed by Iraq, nor B, likely lead to enforcement of all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq. So the language ties them together, but there is no evidence of there being a connection.
Interesting that the right wing spent so much time and energy kind of bashing the infidelity of Bill Clinton during his administration, given that I think taking the world to war on their spurious and disproven reasons is the ultimate act.
We did it because we could.
Exactly.
We were right next door. We were sweeping with Afghanistan. We were right there.
Why did you do it?
The troops are right there, and we're just like, hey, look, there's Iraq. We're here. We can do it. We did it.
As long as we're here, let's get busy. That's the problem.
But that's what it is. It's because we could. I mean, how much therapy does the country have to go through to deal with that?
Well,
thanks for stealing my riff from us.
But you know what? At a point, this country's going to have to confront what this war actually means. And we're not going to know for another 5 to 10 years, when, God, I'll have more gray hair than I have now, exactly what this war has meant to the people outside this country. We're going to know what it means here.
Right.
There are going to be families that we don't even know about, who are going to have to heal, people who are going to come back with you know, missing limbs, debilitating injuries.
Right.
There was a story about one woman who came back from Iraq and it wound up homeless inside of 2 months after she got back here.
They don't take care of the veterans coming back.
But that will be the test, the multi-year test on if really this effort to go into Iraq established the point at which they spread democracy through the Middle East. That was, you know, if they say that's what their goal, that's a neoconservative's goal, that will take several years. And, you know, I don't know what I will eat. This computer, if that actually happens.
Will you?
Because we're going to hold you today.
We're already short one computer because someone ripped one off.
It's a bad computer anyway.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there is going to be a price to be paid for this kind of unilateral foolishness that we are, at this point, not really aware of. We're too close to it. God help us, we elect this guy again, and the world is going to look at us like we don't know what we're doing, and we don't know what our real place is in terms of leadership on the world stage. That's what's at stake.
And worse than that, they're going to think we're stupid.
Yeah, that's
and they already think we're kind of stupid in this country.
And slow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if, like, the majority of this country, well, they don't need a majority anymore. They can just go ahead and take it if they want it.
To the courts.
Yeah,
to the courts
right.
we go. And where we stop, nobody knows. Still to come, TV mogul and friend of Bill, Harry Thomason, talks about the hunting of the president, plus the liberal agenda. This is Air America Radio.
Friday, Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
What's going on? Sue Ellicott is here.
Hey. Hello.
Maybe you can address that. I hear you. Maybe you can address that. Riley?
What?
Got an email here. Please educate me. Does the U.S. Constitution give the vice president the authority to order the military to shoot down a civilian airplane unless the president is dead and without invoking the 25th Amendment? Can the vice president direct a general to do anything? I don't think so.
I'm not sure he's in the military chain of command.
No, I don't think he can.
I think it goes from the president to the secretary of defense. Doesn't go that way first?
Yeah, I think. We don't have a Secretary of War.
But as I thought it was, I think it was Cheney gave Bush the order, then Bush gave it back to Cheney.
Back to Cheney, yeah. Well, did Cheney say essentially that Bush told him to issue the order? Is that how he's trying to spin this whole thing?
When I read it, it was sort of unclear.
It was vague,
like,
wasn't it?
It was. It was like, you know, Bush was at this school. He was alerted. He continued reading and looking frightened. And then all of a sudden, Cheney was in charge and making, you know, phone calls and trying to make things happen. And then by the time he actually executed the order to shoot a plane down, that everything was already down, and he had no idea whether or not, you know, planes were still in the air or not. There was a lot of confusion.
Who do you think he was? Al Haig or something?
Yeah,
you remember Al Haig?
I'm in charge here.
There's a little timeline here.
I don't know. I'm not sure exactly who Dick Cheney thinks he is, because here's a guy who thinks nothing of driving himself to the Pentagon, driving himself to the CIA, and telling them what he wants them to do in the way of gathering intelligence and the kind of intelligence he wanted and the administration wanted. That sounds to me like a boss, not the second in command.
Running through the bunkers underneath, running through the tunnels under the White House. Like, come on,
yeah, come on.
Protect the evil master.
Actually, it's not even all that funny. Dick Cheney is a malevolent boil on the backside of the American body politic, as far as I'm concerned. I just made that part up.
Here's a bit of a timeline from today's Wall Street Journal about Bush in the school. It says that there is no evidence. The report said that until he left the school about 30 minutes later, there was no evidence that he or any of the senior staff with him contacted the Pentagon. It said that, quote, no decisions were made, unquote, by the president or the staff with him while at the school, except for an initial decision to return to Washington.
Yeah, get me out of here. That was his initial decision.
Mm-mm.
Okay, just before boarding Air Force One at 9:45, he heard that the Pentagon had also been hit, and he added that his first response was to ask the Secret Service about the safety of his family. He then called Mr. Cheney.
Was his family at the Pentagon?
I don't think so.
Why would he ask about the safety of his family after he hears the Pentagon got hit?
And the president said,
game over, man! Game over!
Yeah, right?
It's taking a long time for his game to be over, but, you know, we are counting the months.
I heard a story, and I hate to speculate about these things, but there was a story I read around the actual time of September 11th, that Rumsfeld himself wasn't aware that the Pentagon had been hit until, in fact, the Pentagon was hit. Somebody actually had to run in and say to him, oh, you know what? Right down the hall, gone. Something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah. We got Harry Thomasson is waiting to come in, the president's friend and also the filmmaker of The Hunting of the President. And he will be in here in just a second. So come back. We're going to take your calls a little later. A lot of fun coming up. Good morning, it's Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. We have a guest in studio tonight, the documentary The Hunting of the President. It portrays Clinton as the target of a political smear campaign. It talks about everything, I think, that the vast right-wing conspiracy talks about, I'm sure, the sex scandal, the Whitewater scandal. The filmmaker, Harry Thomasson, is in the house with us now. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. It's good to be here, guys.
So
good
it opens
morning.
Tonight, huh, at the Angelica.
We open tonight at the Angelica, and we need fill every one of those seats so we can expand this picture across the country.
So Bill's back in the news. He's got a book coming out. He's got this film. Why do you think it's important to bring all that stuff back, the scandal, the sex lies and videotape, all that stuff?
Well, the only reason this film is coming out now, Mark, is that we're slow. We thought it would take us 6 months to do this thing, and it took us 18 months. And so we really wanted to be out 6 months ago. But we tell a good old-fashioned story. I tell you, if you come see this picture, I don't care what your political stripe, you'll like it because it's a good old-fashioned mystery story, too.
Oh, yeah. And what does it reveal? What's the narrative of the film?
You know, when Hillary Clinton said there was a vast right-wing conspiracy, she was on the right track. And we just show how it wasn't a vast conspiracy. It was just there were three groups with three separate motives. One, a political motive. One, they just wanted to make money out of it. And one, they just hated Bill Clinton. And it's how this Confederacy of Dunces all sort of amalgamated themselves together,
right,
and tried to change and overthrow an election in this country.
How much money went into that investigation? Wasn't it like, you know, $81 million or something that went into the investigation of Clinton's sexual impropriety?
There are various reports that it was somewhere between $77 million and $81
million. Unbelievable.
Yeah, but we spent $13 million investigating 9/11.
That's
makes
it,
sense
right?
to me. Right?
Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah.
Harry Thompson, the book, the movie that comes out tonight is based on a book by Joe Connison and Gene Lyons. How much do you think that it's really a sort of an exercise in kind of negative nostalgia and something that the, you know, the Democrats don't really want to see? And how much does it kind of really kind of throw us into the present with a kind of a right, potential right-wing conspiracy against Kerry?
Well, I'll tell you, it just shows how small groups can affect elections.
Mm-hmm.
And they were almost effective. Guys, you know, in South America, you use bullets to overthrow presidents. But using dirty tricks in this country, if the president's overthrown, the results are the same. And so the whole film is about you've always got to be watchful for these little splinter groups out there that are so radical, they'll do anything.
The neoconservatives we're talking about?
The neoconservatives we're talking about. And so Kerry always has to keep a watchful eye on these groups, and we all do.
I'm not sure it's even just the neoconservatives. I think it's just, you know, extreme right-wing conservatives, full stop.
These guys are shameless, man. They're dirty, and they'll do anything.
But talk, if you would, Harry Thompson, about the social component of these groups' hatred of Bill Clinton, because you deal with that right at the top of the film, where they talk about Bill Clinton coming to Washington and the establishment apparently just finding him socially unacceptable.
You know, the best way I can describe it, the day of the inauguration, the Washington Post had an article contributed to by all their editors, and basically what it said was, all Arkansans go home. We're tired of your smiles, your weepy eyes, your love of Clinton. And every editor there contributed this, and so that told you right off, okay, this could be a rocky ride. There's an outsider coming into the Washington establishment that nobody knows, and he's going to try to change the status quo. And there's always this small little group in Washington that are determined to run things no matter who's in power. He confronted that power, and it caused him trouble from day one.
Is that somewhat of a class thing, or a kind of, you know, north-south thing, or we don't like the fact that you are a kind of self-made man who didn't come to Washington through the sort of elitist channels to which we belong?
He wasn't anointed by the in crowd in Washington, and it was this simple little thing as not inviting the right people to his first party he had there, and some of them felt snubbed and said, "Well, we'll take care of him."
So it was a social element in Washington.
It was also the fact that the White House had had the presidency. I mean, the Republicans had had the presidency for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to do anything not to give it up. And they were stunned when they lost it. And so they were determined to take it back.
And this guy was such a brilliant guy. I mean, he was anointed to some degree that he was a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, this is a real visionary person, Clinton. And this was a guy that was much more intelligent than most of them and saw, you know, what they were going to say before they even said it.
In 1989, mm-hmm. I was at a party in a backyard mm-hmm. at a estate in Little Rock overlooking the Arkansas River. And who was on the stage playing the guitar but Lee Atwater,
right?
It was then, I if I remember correctly, was head of the Republican National Committee.
Yeah, he had just done Willie Horton the year before.
That he had done Willie Horton, and my wife and I happened to be in Little Rock because we, you know, have roots there, and we were invited to this party. Lee Atwater was there, and it was a late afternoon, and before the afternoon was over, the Clintons came to the party. They were introduced to Lee Atwater. In fact, somewhere we have a picture of us and the Clintons and Lee Atwater together. After that, Lee Atwater came back to Washington, and he said, basically, this is paraphrasing, but he said, guys, I've met Darth Vader, and he is coming to get us. And
well,
we
listen,
better stop him now.
I can verify that the Clintons invited the wrong people to their parties, because I got invited to two of them. I still don't know why. But you know what struck me about being at the – I was invited to the White House twice, and what struck me was that there were groups of people who were obvious Clinton haters. Bob Novak, all of these conservative comments, and they were standing in line with me getting ready to shake the guy's hand.
Oh, yeah, they'll hate you, but if they get a photo opportunity, they're always around.
They're always with you. Oh, Cindy Adams, all these different people who you know by their writing, by their whole stance, can't stand them. And I could never figure out why he was so accommodating.
Inclusiveness.
Well, you know, a lot of Clinton's friends have always said one of his worst traits is he forgives his enemies too easily. And I think that may be so.
Yeah. How do you feel about the way he's handling, he's rehandling the Lewinsky thing in the press right now?
You know, I don't know how I feel about it. I know that at some point he had to handle it, and he might as well handle it now as later.
Because it's weird, even with with me, in the same way I felt initially that they were sort of crucifying this guy over something that was certainly didn't require that. But even now, when he says, I did it because I could, as a human person and as a man, I understand.
but was he wrong for saying that? I mean, that's been the front page of every newspaper in this city, which I guess is pretty typical. But, I mean, was he wrong to say because I could?
I guess if it was truthful, we can't say it was wrong. So I'm not going to change
it. In politic, perhaps?
Well, it was probably in politic. But he's actually done a lot of things. His social agendas for the country and everything were somewhat in politic. And he was... Contrary to popular opinion, he's never been afraid to do that. You know, I laugh that everybody's saying this book was late coming out. Oh, he's late as usual. Well, this presidential memoir is coming out far ahead of what any presidential memoir ever has from the time they left office to the book.
Have you read it?
You know, he calls me on the weekend for the past 6 or 7 months.
We've heard about that.
Yeah, and he would read large sections. And
really?
And here's what you'll get out of this. This guy's a good writer.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he wrote this thing with a yellow legal pad and a big pen, just like my wife, who can't use a word processor either. And he said writing the book about killing him, it's taken so much time and energy. He's been up at 4 o'clock in the morning writing it.
We've heard about that.
Yeah.
I think the thing about him being in politics is that he's spoken out kind of very clearly about the therapy he's had with his wife, the family therapy, that what separates him perhaps from many other men who would just say, because I could, is that he stuck with his marriage.
That's exactly right.
Well, she stuck with his marriage.
Well, that's true.
So when he called you, did you just sort of put it on speaker and do your work around the house?
No. Yeah. I liked it because it was entertaining. I'll tell you what he does.
Yeah.
He writes about the same characters that Mark Twain and Damon Runyon wrote about. Mm-hmm. Sort of offbeat, irascible, really interesting
rustic
people
folk.
And flawed and flawed people.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And the stories are so touching and funny that I believe everybody will love the book. It only gets dull once he gets to Washington. He starts rehashing what we've already known. Right. We all know.
You have to afford the $35 for it.
Let's face it. Most of the people in Washington are dull. And once you go there, I mean, you sort of then become dull, too.
Wow. So the movie is compelling, though, and exciting. Susan McDougall, I saw on CNN.
Man, Susan McDougall, what... You know, if there's anybody tougher than Susan McDougall, I don't know.
Yeah.
Such a...
And she seems
such
really...
a lady, but she is really at peace with herself, and she believes that going to prison for 2 years made her a better person.
Right.
I was just going to take the Dale Carnegie course myself.
Yeah, absolutely. She's
well,
better
Harry,
than me.
Harry, thanks a lot for being here, and go see the movie, you guys. It's called The Hunting of the President. It's at the Angelica tonight, and it'll fill in all those gaps about Bill Clinton that you didn't know about. It's a very compelling film. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, now I got to say, hey, come back. I just ended the conversation. I was going to leave with Harry. This morning's edition, we'll see you on the other side of the break. Come back, Air America Radio. Good morning. It's Friday. We're coming in for landing. It's morning's edition on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. Sue Ellicott is here. Mark Riley is here.
Yep.
Yes, it's now time for the countdown to democracy. As the deadline for handover power to the Iraqis approaches, we'd like to explore various issues and opportunities the Iraqis and the Americans will face. Today's issue is executive turnover. All right. We're going to have differing views on the meaning of the term. All right. Leaders of Iraq... Sooner or later, you're going to have a proper president. Now, how does his term come to an end? No. In a functioning democracy, we have something called term limits. The fact that the chief executive has a definite expiration date makes it a lot less likely that people will try to kill him. Now, I know we've had assassination attempts in America, but those people are just plain impatient. Here in the States, most of us know that if you don't like the president, his term will end someday, or he'll resign in disgrace. It's a win-win. Term limits prevent a leader from staying in power too long and becoming dictatorial. And shooting off rifles at public celebrations. I don't have to tell you. With Saddam, the only real way to get him to take some time off was for a foreign superpower to launch a major invasion, costing them over 800 dead and in excess of $140 billion in counting. But I digress. Listen, bottom line, establish term limits or someone will establish them for you. Whoa. Was that meant for me? All right, good luck. God bless. This is day 12 in our countdown to democracy. Live free or die. All right, okay. Hey.
Great. Come on now.
Guess what time it is now? It's now time for Mark Riley's Dog of the Week.
Hey, this week's dog was narrowed down real fast, and the central issue involved was the link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, which we've been talking about for most of the morning. You may remember this as one of the big reasons the U.S. went to war in Iraq and has thus far spent more than 800 American lives. It seems the Bush administration now has a revolving sushi cart of reasons for this unilateral action. It also has a sushi cart of administration lackeys who try to explain Bush's incoherent logic. This week's Spin the Bottle landed on Vice President Dick Cheney, making him hands down Dog of the Week. On Monday, he reopened a can of worms about the Saddam Al-Qaeda connection with a speech he gave at the James Madison Institute, a conservative think tank. In spite of finding after finding some by the administration itself that there was no direct evidence of a link, Cheney said there was. This set off a week of controversy over the issue. After Cheney made his assertion, Bush felt it necessary to back him up with linguistic flips we all know he isn't capable of pulling off. Just when everyone thought it was safe, here comes the 9/11 Commission contradicting both Bush and Cheney. The panel says Osama bin Laden asked Saddam for help once in the 1990s and got no reply. That, the panel says, is the extent of Iraqi Al-Qaeda cooperation that they can find. So, Mr. Vice President, your little statement on Monday managed to get you and your alleged boss, the president, an entire week of bad publicity. Is it any wonder some people in your own party think you ought to be replaced by Rudy Giuliani?
Yeah.
Face facts, Dick. You are the annoying, evil face of a doomed administration and the morning sedition Dog of the Week.
That's actually Dick Cheney.
Yes, it is.
Beautiful. Absolutely right. Right on the money.
Hey, we try.
Mark Riley, Dog of the Week, the new big segment. Perfect. Dick Cheney, the master of all evil things, just waiting for that weird lizard to crawl out of his nose, across his face, into his other
into ear. Into his ear.
I am the Dark Lord.
Into his kennel.
Tom DeLay would be sitting there going, oh, no, it's happening in public. Mm-hmm. Oh, this was our secret. Oh, no.
The New York Times had a great photograph taken, I think, in the Rose Garden or somewhere this week, all the administration officials, including Bush, were in soft focus at the front, and then in glaring, did you see it? Glaring in the background was, in perfectly focused, was Dick Cheney.
I can imagine why.
Oh, there it is from the Streisand compound. Today's liberal agenda. Why am I phrasing like that? All right, here you go. Here, get your notebooks, get your pencils. One, question why 9/11 Commission report didn't list one of the main causes of the attacks as bad karma. Two, have definition of rape expanded to include ogling, checking out, sizing up, and looking in the general direction of. Three, add Abu Musab al-Zarqawi to your Heroes of the Oppressed photo collage. Four, have marijuana legalized as a treatment for depression, weight loss, and weekdays. Of course. And weekends, it's a given. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into any conversation. I'm against the use of airplanes as a terrorist weapon because of the horrific waste of fossil fuels.
All right.
Have a good weekend. I know I will.
Coming up on Monday's morning's edition, on the heels of Father's Day, we'll look at the warm, loving relationship between President Bush and his father. No, not God. His biological poppy. Plus, former Clinton Labor Secretary Robert Reich will help us Monday morning quarterback Clinton's 60 Minutes interview. That's Monday's morning's edition. Stick around for Unfiltered, the El Franken Factor, Randy, and more fun on Air America Radio. See ya.